UK Wine Show, show number 195. Tim Hannay on why food and wine matching doesn't work. G'day, welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we destroy all your thoughts on food and wine matching. We're talking with Tim Hannay, the Swami of Umami, on why food and wine matching is wrong. In the spotlight, we're looking at malolactic fermentation. And this week, while it's midterm break, I spent all of yesterday ice skating and bowling with 2 5-year-old girls. Now, I'd like to say that I was great at bowling, but I was beaten by a 5-year-old. And my ice skating is a wee bit better, but today I'm really sore, so I don't think I'll be doing ice skating for a while. Still, quite a bit to organise for my trip to Hong Kong, Australia, New Zealand and America. But hopefully I'm going to get it all tidied up before I leave next week. A lot of last minute panicking there going on. But let's crack on with this week's show. And the first thing in this week's show is our mystery region. As usual, I'm going to give you 2 sets of clues. One set now, 1 set just before the interview. And I want you to work out what you think the mystery region is. So here goes. Our mystery region has steep slopes that form a valley. To create the terraces on which the vines grow, sedimentary rock is broken up using dynamite. With the upper layer of soil loosened, the vines can then push down through their roots as far as 25 meters to get water. The varieties need to be extremely resilient because the climate here in the region is very harsh. The winters are bitterly cold, although it does really snow out there. And while the summer is temperate enough, it often reaches 41 degrees Celsius. Have we think about that? There are some clues in there for the really good of you who'll get it straight away. But have we think about it, and I'll give you the next clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Sunday newspaper The Observer has scaled down its weekly wine column, written by Tim Atkin, MW, for the past 17 years from 900 words to just 2 wine recommendations and tasting notes of 40 words each. Tim Atkin will still appear in The Observer Food Monthly, the paper's colour supplement. It's a growing trend, with The Times bringing their wine column in-house in 2009 and The Independent on Sunday cutting their column the previous year. But a Facebook site called Save the Wine Column has been launched by wine journalist Rebecca Gibb, and it's had over 700 members and still growing. But it's not all doom and gloom for wine writers. There's still weekly wine columns in the UK's 4 major daily broadsheets, the Financial Times, Telegraph, The Independent and The Times.
It's a shame Tim's column has been decreased in size, but this is tough times for the paper industry. They're losing market revenue to the internet. While everybody says the internet democratises wine and allows everyone to be a wine critic, the historical gatekeepers are getting lost in the noise. And why pay a decent rate for Tim's advice when anybody can have their say on the web? And while wine recommendations are great, let's face it, it's quite handy to have a good recommendation. As you're going to find out later on when we talk to Tim Hannay, there's no point following critic if their palate is not the same as yours. So wine recommendations, at best, are only relevant for a percentage of the readers. It's the insightful comments that are more valuable to me, and these are the things that are being dropped. I'd hate to be in the paper business. One business that is growing is UK Wines. How are they improving quality, Jane?
Well, a training project for the UK wine industry called Wine Skills has been launched by Plumpton College, thanks to funding by DEFRA and the European Union. The course will offer great growers and winemakers in the UK practical workshops, masterclasses and a mentoring scheme designed to ensure the sustainable growth of the industry. The mentors, announced by Chris Foss, who's head of wine at Plumpton, are viticulturist Peter Hayes, flying winemaker David Cowdroy, Jean-Manuel Jacquinot from Champagne Jacquinot, and Michael Poole, the former MD of Western Wines.
Plumpton's had a huge influence on improving the quality of English wine, and hopefully this will help producers improve again. One area where producers have let themselves down is in south of France. What's going on there with those red bikes?
Well, we covered this story last week about the French court case surrounding Gallo's fake Pinot Noir, and it's concluded with a guilty verdict for 12 producers and traders from the southwest of France. According to reports in the Times Online, the fraudsters made 7 million euros in profit, that's £6 million, by passing off cheaper Syrah and Merlot grape varieties as Pinot Noir, which Gallo then sold in the United States under the Red Bicyclette Pinot Noir brand. the court passed suspended prison sentences and fines ranging from €3,000 to €180,000. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website, 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. According to The Guardian, the court made it clear who it believed was the kingpin of the affair. Claude Corset, head of Ducasse Wine Merchants, who acted as an intermediary between the local producers and a conglomerate that sold the wine to Gallo. Corset was given a 6-month suspended sentence and a fine of €45,000. Sieur Dacquiers, the trading company that worked with Gallo on the popular brand of Red Bicyclette wines, was ordered to pay €180,000. 8 co-ops were in on the con, supplying Ducasse with the produce. Ducasse, then for an estimated profit of $3.7 million, sold the wine on to Sieur Dacquiers, which sold it on bulk to Gallo. Ducasse seems to be capturing the margin here, but with a fine of only €45,000, it doesn't seem to offset his €3.7 million profit. To me, this seems a bit of a minor slap in the face for selling Merlot and Shiraz as Pinot Noir. But the lawyer for Sieur Dacquiers told the French press agency, "There is no prejudice. Not a single American consumer complained." I had a look at some of the ratings on the Smooth website, which is a website that's with lots of ratings on it from public, and mostly they like the wine, with comments like, "One of our favourite inexpensive wines. Goes wonderful with meaty cheese tray. Heavy iron taste and powerful tannins." And the last comment, "I had a bottle recently at the restaurant and found it very good. In fact, it was so tasty that I shared it with the cook and the people at the next table." I'm sure the wine delivers for the price point. After all, Gallo know how to buy wines that the consumer wants to drink. But perhaps their top wine buyers can't tell the difference in Shiraz and Pinot, which is what this case proves, or worse. One last thing is that congratulations to the French department that took the brave action to take the accused to court. So, good on you. Okay, that's that news this week. Next up, we have the spotlight. This week, we're looking at malolactic fermentation. Exciting stuff. But malolactic fermentation, or MLF, MILF, not quite MILF, but MILF, that'll do, is a conversion of sharper, stronger citrus green apple like malic acid into a softer, creamier, lower acidic milk-like acid called lactic acid. A further byproduct is carbon dioxide. Now, it naturally occurs during or just after normal alcoholic fermentation, unless the winemaker stops it by adding sulfur dioxide to the wine. Most reds undergo malolactic fermentation, but not all whites. Typically, if you're in a cool climate with high acidity, you will carry out MLF to soften the wine, while in hot climates where acidity can be a problem, malolactic fermentation is often avoided to preserve the fresh nature of the wine. Many Chardonnays have a buttery, creamy taste, and that buttery flavour is associated with malolactic fermentation, and is the reason why many Chardonnays have it. Particularly if the wine's had oak barrel ageing, it seems to go quite nicely with oak barrel ageing. Buttery flavours aren't the only ones, though. You can get caramel flavours, which are not uncommon, but not all flavours are desirable. Some wines can develop a rancid butter, sweaty, or even mouse taint. Off flavours can be managed by selecting lactic bacteria and inoculating with a particular lactic bacteria. Occasionally, some winemakers give wines partial malolactic fermentation. That is, some of the wine is separated out and allowed to go through malolactic fermentation. When added back in, the wine has a blend of racy malic acid and the fatter, softer lactic acid. In this way, winemakers can control the mouthfeel of the wine. Now, lactic bacteria is sensitive to temperature, alcohol, sulfur dioxide, and acidity, so it can be a bit of a tough one to get going. Sulfur dioxide is the easiest and most reliable way to stop it occurring, but occasionally some wines do have a slight spritz to them and can have quite off tastes, and that's most likely because of malolactic fermentation. Be careful though, some wines do have a spritziness which is absolutely natural for them and helps give a slight lift to the wine. Okay, that ends this week's spotlight. Next week, if I ever get finished the book, hopefully I'll be reviewing Natalie McLean's Red Wine and Drunk All Over. But next up, we have our second clue in our mystery wine region. Here it is. Our mystery wine region and valley gets its name from the river that winds more than 500 miles from its source in Spain through Portugal to Oporto, where it flows into the Atlantic Ocean. More than 30 grape varieties grow in this port wine region, but only 5 are essential components for fine port. But the varieties need to be fairly resilient because of the extreme climates. That's the last clue. Many of you should get the region by now. If not, I'm going to give you the answer after the interview, which is coming up next with Tim Hanai, the Swami of Umami. We're going to be talking with Tim about why food and wine matching is all wrong. Let's have a listen to what Tim has to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Tim Hanai. You're a master of wine and an expert on sensations and food.
Yes, I'm a trained chef.
Trained chef.
But my wine interest actually preceded my culinary interest and actually led to it. And now I do research on what's called the psychosensory phenomenon, which is how our brains and our sensory receptors work to create what we think is reality or not.
I've sort of learned that some people are classed as non-tasters, normal, and super-tasters. But you,
right.
You sort of use that, but you've changed the terminology.
Well, and I actually work with the scientist who invented that, Dr. Linda Bartoshuk from Yale University School of Medicine. So basically what it was found that there was, it's a thyroid medication, and it was spilled in a laboratory about 100 years ago, and some people are gasping and wheezing and said, oh, I got this horrible bitter taste in my mouth. Others were saying, well, I'm getting, you know, why are you overreacting? And other people were saying, what are you talking about? And they weren't experiencing it all. So Dr. Bartoshuk actually worked to look at the genetic markers that could indicate whether you were what they call a super taster, which means it's horrible, bitter, disgusting.
Yep.
A taster, which it's bitter, it may build in intensity, but it's relatively tolerable. Or a non-taster, it just tastes like a piece of wet paper. And you absolutely are physiologically incapable of sensing it.
Okay, so what is that? How does that apply to wine?
Well, what we've been looking at is actually a more holistic sense, and because of the unfortunate wording, oh, I'm a super taster. It's actually what we're working on: the people with the most taste buds who live in a very vivid and sometimes excruciating sensory world. We call them hypersensitive tasters.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, they love salt. They either can't stand coffee or have to put so much cream and sugar in it, or drink tea with milk and sugar. Hypersensitive taster also very typically will find diet sodas and artificial sweeteners horribly bitter and metallic, not sweet. So this is all indicative of more taste buds in a holistic sense. And you will probably be hypersensitive to the prop, but it doesn't mean you're a super taster. It means just highly sensitive.
Prop is the chemical that thyroid drug.
That's correct.
What's its full name again? Do you know?
It's 6N6 propyl tiracil.
I could never remember. Yeah. I remember it's prop as
well. Yeah, exactly. It says prop, yeah.
Okay.
Tiarea, actually. It's another, I use a form of, it's called tiarea that I usually carry. So what we, with that work, I've just been so curious why experts can be at so polar odds about in disagreement on wine quality. And it's like they're not even experiencing the same thing.
Yep.
And it turns out that's actually what's often happening. So what we've done is if we set up a simple set of questions, and we actually have a survey at bibendumtimes.com, and we'd love everybody to take the survey because we're collecting more information. This is the first time it's been done in the UK. So the traits of a hypersensitive taster are they love things that are sweet, and they may have migrated to dry wine, but it has to be delicate. It has to be smooth.
Yep.
And so there are specific requirements. So we actually break down that there are sweet tasters, typically with the most taste buds, and their demand is sweet. And they love salt.
Why do they like salt?
Because it suppresses bitterness.
Ah, yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is it. And the conventional wisdom is that people dumping salt on their food don't have taste buds, when the truth is they've got the most.
Okay. But sugar hides bitterness as well.
It masks it. Yes. And so, you know, they've got certain behaviors, and that's why the heavy cream and sugar in the coffee and binding proteins and stuff like that, or the phenolics in it. So it very heavily influences your preferences in beverages and foods. Hypersensitive tasters are picky eaters.
Yep.
So if your children are dumping salt on their food and picky, it just means they've got a lot of taste buds. So don't punish them. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Just because they've got good taste.
And the other extreme are what we call tolerant taste. Tolerant tasters have the least taste buds, mostly men, and they don't even get the bitterness. They don't they don't experience the tan in the red wines. They're smooth.
Yep.
And what's very interesting, a hypersensitive taster would get a burning hot experience with high alcohol. The tolerant taster, it actually tastes sweet. And this is actually quantified.
Okay.
So you've got people arguing, oh, this wine's over the top, it's too oaky, it's too this, while the other goes, what are you talking about, this impeccable balance and beautiful? And they're literally having two different experiences.
So what do you call them again? Sweet? Hypersensitive is sweet.
Right. So our the range is, we start at tolerant, the least taste buds. Sensitive is the middle group. They can go a lot of different directions. It's almost equally men and women.
Yep.
Then hypersensitive, and then finally sweet.
Okay, so sweet's very hypersensitive.
That's correct. And the next step is autistic. And seriously.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, because can you get an idea of someone's autism by looking at their taste buds?
If you actually look at some of the work being done, CNN did a piece on autism. And if you – they hooked an autistic person up to a computer to communicate. And it's just absolutely brilliant. I get chills every time I think of watching this, because they're living in this absolutely different sensory world that you can't even imagine, and their brain can't actually cope with all the sensations they're getting.
Oh, okay.
So it's really, so you know, we're working with behavioral scientists and psychologists and neurologists and sensory scientists all around the world on this project, so we can better stand ourselves, better understand each other, and then figure out, what does this mean at the dining table with your children and your spouse's wine preferences? And if you're a wine expert, why do they go so wacko and talk, you know, in tongues and do the things we do?
You were talking earlier as well, I was listening to you talk to a few people, and you were talking about whether a woman had any morning sickness.
Yes.
As an indication of their sensitivity. What's that all about?
So sometimes I actually feel like not a master of wine, but a moron of wine. That's my MW. But I work with all these people, and they send me work. And so twice in one day, I received studies that correlated heavy salt use to morning sickness.
Oh, okay.
Now, then I knew I could correlate heavy salt use to number of taste buds. So then I sort of reversed engineered it, and I found it that if a man hits all the markers of hypersensitivity, it's about a 90% sure chance their mother had severe morning sickness.
Really? What about females?
It's more like about a 60 or 70% likelihood, because they're simply more hypersensitive to begin with as a gender. And so there are gender biases, but there are many, many, many men who are sweet tasters and hypersensitive tasters. And very often they just abandon wine. It's too crazy. They don't. And they, even if wine is their beverage of choice, they'll drink cocktails because they can have something sweet, and the wine people are idiots.
So what about wine and food matching then? If everybody's tasting things slightly differently, you know, people talk about, you know, a nice Chianti or a Bordeaux with a big piece of steak. And I can understand the proteins binding to tannins.
They don't.
The mouth. They don't.
Nope. Doesn't even happen.
Oh, crap. You better tell me.
Yeah. We're going to. So it's really funny. So I, my seminal moment was almost 20 years ago. I had invited over 30 scientists to the Napa Valley to listen to my wine and food shtick and to tear it apart. And I got up about, now try the steak and try the red wine and see, it gets softer and whatever. And then I went on to a very detailed explanation of the negatively charged polyphenolics and the colloidally suspended in the wine and the positively charged proteins denatured by the, and they went, nah. I said, what do you mean, nah? I said, try the steak, try the wine. He said, it's not the steak, and that whole fat thing actually makes no sense. Have you ever tried the steak without salt on it? It's just the goddamn salt we put on it.
I don't put salt on anything.
Right. And so, and that would be a sign of a tolerant taster, so you don't get it anyway. So
high
you,
blood pressure. It's a sign of high blood pressure.
Oh, got it. Yes, exactly. That as well. But so what we did was, it was like, oh, crap, my world was actually really collapsing this day completely around me. Everything I said, well, we do that because of that, and they're all going, no, you're full of crap. So we actually started to do controlled experiments. Take some olive oil, which is a nearly pure form of fat, and take some red wine and try the wine. It'll work with white wine too. Try the olive oil and then try the wine again. It gets more bitter. fat does not make the wine smoother. It doesn't even happen.
So what's working? Because it does go quite nicely usually.
What's that? The steak? The
steak and nice.
Oh, for you, it's only a metaphor. It's just an image in your head. And for others around you, it's not even happening. And anybody who puts salt on it, it's happening, but it'll happen with chicken or fish or anything else. So we have done exhaustive and thorough studies, and this actually we'll have to spend the day in the kitchen at my house in Napa sometime and just go take you through this, because for people who do wine and food matching, I'm Satan. I mean, they just can't believe any of this, but believe me, everything I'm saying has been tested, it's been proven. And in that room that day 20 years ago, I had two people who had done their PhD on lubricity. Lubrication of the mouth with saliva replacement and whatever. And they said, yeah, we know that old story and it's not true. And then what happens if you have butter and try wine, if you do unsalted butter, the wine will get stronger. If you do salted butter, it'll get milder. It's the salt suppressing the bitterness, not the butter, not the fat, not the steak.
Okay, that's interesting. So
what
other food and wine matching things are wrong?
Everything.
Everything. I can see why people call you Satan.
When you have high levels of salt and acidity in your food, the bitterness in the wine is suppressed and the sourness of the wine is reduced.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When you have sweet in your food, your wine becomes more sour and more bitter.
I've always thought sugar hides bitterness.
Have you ever brushed your teeth and then taken a drink of orange juice?
Oh, yeah. It's horrible.
That's exactly what happens, because that's not masking the bitterness in the food. And it's and remember, sugar masks bitterness. Salt suppresses it. So it's actually two different phenomenon. So what happens is something called sensory adaptation.
Yeah, you get used to something.
You get used to it, or it grossly exaggerates it the other way. So a great example is you go swimming in the pool and it's cold. You go play in the sprinklers, it's ice cold. When you go back in the water, it seems warm.
Yeah.
All right, so that's adaptation. When you actually put sweet things in your food, and this is why so many Asian foods and whatever make the wine seem unpleasant with it. It's just the sweetness that's there that's not in classical French or classical Italian cuisine. And so this one's really easy. Just eat a sweet grape, not a sour grape, but a sweet one, and then try some wine. And for most people, especially the hypersensitive ones, it's horrible, bitter, and whatever. And the funny thing is, when chefs do wine and food matching, they conjure up a vision, oh, this has raspberries and cherries or whatever, and they put that in the food, and they actually make the wine and food suck.
Okay.
Yeah, it's crazy, but it's really true.
What about things like turkey and cranberry sauce?
Yeah, you have to essentially balance the acidity and the salt very, very carefully, all right? Because the sweetness of a cranberry sauce, actually, if you add a little extra lime juice and make sure to put salt in, it's actually going to make the cranberry seem sweeter a little bit by suppressing the bitterness, but it'll also mitigate how it's going to react with the wine. So you can literally take your cranberry sauce, try the wine you want to serve, and it'll probably suck. Put a couple drops of lime juice and just a tiny bit of salt, and the cranberry sauce will taste better, and your wine will become smoother and much, much nicer.
Wow, that certainly puts the cat amongst the pigeons regarding food and wine matching. I'm going to have to rewrite some of my wine notes and food and wine matching, but it's not a complete rewrite. I think it's a small change. What Tim is saying is that wine and food matching is different for different people. Some people who are very sensitive to tannins will find combinations better than others. What surprised me was that people with very high sensitivity to tannins have a high sugar and salt requirement to tone down the tannins. Also, they need to be very careful about desensitizing their palates to the soothing effects. It also ties in with what I was saying earlier about Tim Atkins' wine column. Different people have different perceptions of wine, and you need to find a wine commentator who has a palate the same as yours. Okay, I also have two more interviews with Tim Hannay, which is coming up next week. But before we finish up, how did you get on with the mystery region? It was, of course, the Douro. I think the interview from last week on Portuguese still wines may have helped, but here are the clues again. The steep green slopes of the Douro Valley are situated in northern Portugal near the Spanish border. The valley gets its name from the Douro River, which winds more than 500 miles from its source in Spain through Portugal to Oporto, where it flows out to the Atlantic Ocean. To create the terraces on which the vines grow, sedimentary rock is broken up using dynamite. With the upper layers of soil being loosened, then the vines have to push down through as much as 25 meters to find water. More than 30 grape varieties grow in this port wine region, but only 5 are essential components for fine port. The varieties do need to be extremely resilient because climate in the region is very harsh. The winters are bitterly cold, although it really snows. The summer temperatures can get up to 41 degrees Celsius. Okay, that pretty much ends the show this week, except for our quote. And this time it's from a Mr. H. Longfellow, who's an American poet, and he wrote the epic poem Song of Hiawatha. You may recall that one. I only know the Disney version. Right, here he goes, the quote. When you ask one friend to dine, give him your best wine. When you ask two, the second best will do. Don't know about that, but it rhymes nicely, and I can see where he's going. Bit greedy, but until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.